blood before he became their prince. The prince that Kennet could not have made without me. He's mad, Etta said in a low whisper. I'll happily die here, drowned inside him before he shall have my son. You won't die here, Queen Etta. Sorkor picked up one rum bottle and hefted it thoughtfully, looking at the windows. I don't swim, she said faintly. Paragon is not going to sink, Althea declared firmly, and I wondered if her determination alone could protect us. From outside the stateroom door, Ant's voice reached us.
Sir, I've an axe. Shall I chop my way in?
Not yet,
Brashen ordered to my surprise. Then, to my even greater shock, there came another woman's voice. It rang with authority and was fully as loud as Paragon's.
Harm my family, and I'll see you burn, you faithless pariah. Vivacia,
Althea gasped.
Burn me, Paragon howled. To save your family? Do you think your family matters more to you than mine does to me? Set fire to me, and they'll cook inside me like meat in an oven.
Paragon!
Boyo bellowed the name.
Would you truly do that to me, who was born on your decks and learned to walk here?
The breath he drew shuddered into his lungs.
You named me! You called me Boyo, your Boyo, because you would not call me Trelvestrit. You said I was yours, and that name did not fit me.
A sudden deep silence followed these words. It swelled and deafened us. Then a deep, anguished groan vibrated the deck beneath us. I wondered if the others felt, as I did, a welling of unbearable guilt that washed through me with the sound. I recalled every foolish thing, every evil and selfish thing I had ever done in my life. Shame surged through me so that I longed to die, invisibly and alone. Beneath our feet, the deck was slowly shifting back to level. All around us, I heard the muttering of shifting planks and beams. Then the door was thrown open to reveal a panicky Ant holding an axe. Several crew surrounded her.
The danger has passed,
Brashen said to her, but I was not sure I agreed.
All you crewmen who remain, see to our cargo. Any wet crates, bring them up onto the deck. I know, working in the dark. It can't be helped. I want to be able to offload tomorrow as swiftly as possible.
A brief pause, and then he added,
All hatch covers to be open, and remain so.
Sir,
Ant agreed in a shaky voice, and darted off. Brashen stepped through the door and headed forward, Althea at his heels and Boyo beside her, and we all followed.
I hate this, I said quietly to Amber.
Don't we all? She muttered.
It feels as if my entire future lies outside my control. I want to get off this insane ship and away from these people. I want to leave now.
On the deck, I led her to the railing and stared toward the scattered lights of the pirate town. We can demand to go ashore, use our Rainwild gifts to buy passage on a different vessel, regain some control over our journey, and send Lant and the youngsters home and out of danger.
Are we back to that?
Lant shook his head.
It will not happen, Fitz. I won't go home until you go with me, and it would be foolish and dangerous to send those two off alone on a long voyage with people we do not know. Whatever we face, I feel they are safer with us.
It's not a matter of safer for me,
Purr muttered darkly. I ignored them all and stared at the lights. I wanted to shake all over like a wolf would shake off the rain and run off alone into the darkness to do what I must. I felt caged by responsibilities. What was best for us? Then we should leave this ship tonight, all of us. Find other passage to Clarys.
We can't,
said the fool. Not Amber. I turned my head to look at him. How did he do that? How did he shed one mask and don another so easily? Despite the rouge and powder, he turned my friend's face to me.
We have to go there on this ship, Fitz.
Why?
I told you.
He sounded both patient and exasperated, in a way only the fool could manage.
I've begun to dream again. Not many dreams, but the ones that reached me rang with clarity and with inevitability. If we are going to Clarice, we travel on this ship. It's a narrow channel I navigate to reach my goal, and only Paragon provides us a passage to the future I must create.
But you never thought to share that information with me until this moment. I did not try to keep the accusation out of my voice. Was this a true thing, or a gambit by the fool to get what he wanted? My distrust of Amber was starting to bleed into my friendship with the fool.
The steps I have trodden to get us to Kelsingrar and then Treehog, to get us onto this ship and thence to Divitown. If I had told you of them, of the things I did, and the things I took care not to do, it would have influenced you. Only by you behaving as you would if you knew nothing of what I did, would we come here.
What?
Lant asked, confused. I could not blame him. I sorted out the fool's words. So of course that means you can't tell me any of your other dreams and warn me what we must do. It must all be left in your hands. He set his gloved hand on the ship's railing.
Yes,
he said quietly.
Balls,
said Perseverance quite distinctly. Spark gave him a shocked look and then rebuked him with a shove. He glared at her.
Well, it's not right. It's not how friends should do things.
Perseverance enough, I said quietly. Lant sighed.
Shouldn't we move up to the bow and see what is going on?
And when he turned and walked that way, we followed. I didn't especially want to go. The deep sobbing of the figurehead and his misery permeated the ship. I paused to reinforce my walls and then walked on with Amber. The fool spoke quietly. The others were far enough ahead that I doubt they heard him.
I won't say I'm sorry. I can't be sorry for something I must do.
I'm not sure that's entirely true, I responded. I could recall many things that I'd had to do, and many of them I regretted.
I'd be sorrier, and so would you, if I began to worry more about your feelings and less about getting to Clarice and rescuing B.
Rescuing B. His words felt like meat dangled for a starving dog. I was tired and battered by Paragon's guilt and grief. I thought your great ambition was to destroy Clarice and kill as many people as you could, or as I could kill for you.
You're angry.
When he said the words aloud, I felt ashamed, and even angrier. I stopped and stood still. I am, I admitted. This is not how I do things, fool. When I kill, I do it efficiently. I know who I'm stalking. I know how to find them and how to end them. This is madness. I'm going into unfamiliar territory. I know little of my targets, and I'm hampered with people I'm responsible for protecting. Then I discover that I'm dancing to your tune, to music I can't even hear. Answer me this, fool. Do I live through this? Does the boy, does Lant go back to Shade? And is his father still alive when he gets there? Does Spark survive? Do you?
Some things are more likely than others,
he said quietly.
And all of them still dance and wobble like a spun coin. Dust blown on the wind. A day of rain. A tide that is lower than expected. Any and all of those things can change everything. You must know that is true. All I can do is peer into a mist and say, It looks most clear in that direction. I tell you that our best chance of finding B alive is to remain on Paragon until he arrives in Clarice.
My pride wanted me to be defiant, but my fatherhood was stronger than my pride. What would I not have done to increase the chance that I might rescue B, might hold her and protect her, and tell her how devastated I was to have failed her, to promise her that never again would she leave my protection. The others had waited for us. Amber's hand squeezed my arm as I led the way to the bow with them trooping behind me. My guard that I must protect as I led them into I knew not what. Amber queried softly,
"Is there a bright light off to our left?"
"There's a lantern on the Vivacia. It's burning very brightly." Some sort of argument was going on over on her deck, though I could not hear the details. I heard,
"Anchor!"
and then a barking of orders to roust someone out of his bed. Amber had turned her face toward the lantern light and opened her light gold eyes wide. A slight smile bowed her mouth. Her pale face reminded me of the moon as she said,
"I can perceive it. My vision is improving slowly, Fitz. So slowly. But I believe it is coming back."
"That would be good," I said, but privately I wondered if she deceived herself. At the bow of the ship, voices had been rising and falling. I recognized Althea's voice raised in a query, but did not catch the words. We were on the outer edges of those who had gathered there, for many of the crew stood between us and the figurehead. It was Paragon who responded.
"No, you of all people should know that I am not Kennet, and that Kennet does not petition you for this. Is Vivacia your father or grandmother? Of course not. It is not Kennet that demands this. It is I, Paragon. A ship made from massacred dragons, both embraced and enslaved by a Bingtown trader family. We had no say in that. No choice but to care, no choice in who we loved, as Ludlucks poured out their blood and souls and memories onto the bones of our deck. I do not ask, I demand. Do I not have the right to him, as much right as his ancestors had to me? Is it not fair?" "It is fair." A female voice, clear and carrying. Vivacia. And suddenly my mind put together the bits of what I had heard. The live ship had dragged her anchor to come closer to Paragon, not just to hear his words, but to add her voice to his.
"Althea, you know it is. Were I setting out on my final voyage, would you deny me, boyo? Listen to them. They have the right to demand Kennetson, after all they have been through as the Ludluck family ship."
"What's happening over there?"
Wintrow demanded in the moment of silence that followed Vivacia's words.
"What must happen?"
Vivacia spoke before any of her crewmen could respond to their captain.
"Did you think I would not hear the truth of what Paragon had spoken? Live ship I am, and a wondrous vessel I have been for your family for generations. But Paragon is right, and deep within we all knew that we had other natures, even before the truth of the so-called Wizard Wood was revealed. I will be a dragon again, Wintrow. I know of no live ship who will not wish to rise up and fly again. So in this, I will follow Paragon, not just to Clarys, but up the Rainwild River afterward, to demand the silver that is the right of every dragon.
You will follow Paragon to Clarice.
You wish to be a dragon.
Althea and Wintrow spoke simultaneously.
I am considering it,
the ship replied judiciously.
Why Clarice?
Brashen's voice was raised in complete confusion.
Why not go directly to Kelsingra? Because a memory stirs in me. A dragon memory. A memory eclipsed by human thoughts and emotions. A memory so overscarred by human experiences that I cannot be certain of anything except a feeling of anger and betrayal that rises in me at the name Clarez. Dragons recall few memories of their serpent years, but there is something that I recall, something intolerable. Yes!
Paragon flung back his head and shouted the word to the night skies. The exultation that rushed through the ship infected me. I fought against the smile that bloomed on my face. His skill was so strong, I thought to myself, and then with a shock recognized the implications of that and felt cold and shaky. I lifted Amber's hand from my forearm and said to Spark, Please take over guiding Lady Amber. I need a time alone to think. Amber clutched my shirt front.
You are leaving? You don't want to stay here and hear what is said?
I took her wrist and tugged her hand free, more roughly than I intended. I could not keep from my voice the unease and the irritation I felt with myself for not recognizing the obvious.
Listening will change nothing. They will decide what becomes of us when we travel and who goes with us.
I have something else I have to ponder. Spark will be with you, and Lantern Purr, but for now, I need to think.
I understand,
she said in a voice that said she did not. But my insight into the ship's ability to manipulate human emotion was too large to share with her. I strode away to the crew quarters. Empty hammocks, only a few sailors' trunks and ditty bags remained. I sat down on someone's sea chest, there in the dark and muggy hold, and pondered. I felt as if I were assembling the pieces of a broken teacup. The silver the live ships craved and the dragons so jealously guarded was the same skill I had seen on Verity's hands when he had carved his dragon. It was the raw stuff of magic, the very essence of it. I'd seen it as a thick slurry on my king's hands, watched him shape stone into a dragon with the power it gave him. In a skill-sharing dream of Verity, I'd seen a river with a wide band of silver in it, running with the water. I'd seen silver tendrilling through a vial of dragon's blood, and witnessed how it had rushed the fool's healing, just as the skill had healed and changed the children of Kelsingra. So the silver was the skill, and the skill was the magic I used with my mind to reach out to touch thoughts with shade. The fool had once insinuated that I had dragon's blood in my veins. Tarman had said I had been claimed by a dragon. Was it the stone dragon I had touched, or an echo of Verity as I had known him? I reordered that thought now. Had I inherited something in my blood? Some trace of actual silver that gave me the power to push my thoughts toward others? Silver traces in the portal stones, in the skill pillars that I could use to travel. Lines of silver in the stones from which Verity had carved his dragon, and in the stone dragons that had slept until, with blood and the touch of my skill, I had woken them. Silver traces in the memory stones that held the records the Elderlings had left for us. What, then, was the skill current I used to reach out for Nettle or Dutiful? It was a force outside me, of that I was sure, and there were others in it, powerful awarenesses that attracted and might absorb me. Who were they? Had I truly felt Verity there? King Shrewd? How did that fit with the silver? I had too many thoughts. My mind leapt from wondering about the skill current to considering what magic I might be able to wield if I were to drink the vials of silver that Rapskull had given me. Temptation vied with fear. Would it grant me great power or a painful death? How much silver was too much for a man's body to absorb? Paragon had grown much more powerful with the silver that Amber had given him. The vials in my pack each held more than twice what he'd taken. Now his emotions exploded from him with a force that I could barely resist. Did he know what he did to humans? Did it affect me more because I'd been trained in the skill? If he understood his power and directed it, would I be able to resist it? Would anyone? When the stone dragons had risen in flight and Verity had led them to battle against the Red Ship raiders, they had affected the minds of the warriors below them. With acid breath, the powerful winds of their wings, and the blows of their lashing tails, they had destroyed our enemies. But worse had been what they did to their minds. To be overflown by the stone dragons was to lose memories. It was not that different from how the Out-Islanders had forged their captives. Even our own men on the ground had felt the effect. Even Verity's presence as a stone dragon had worked it on the guardians of Buckkeep. The recollection of how the Queen and Starling had returned to Buckkeep Castle was a hazy one for those who had witnessed it. The most common telling was that Verity had been astride a dragon when he delivered them to safety, not that the king had become a dragon. Such was the power of the skill, of silver to confuse and confound, to steal memory, and perhaps one's humanity. As my serving folk had been confounded on the night that B was taken, had they used silver or dragon's blood to work that magic, to make all my people forget how they had come and stolen my child, to forget that she had even existed? Could that same magic be used against them? I dared myself to imagine drinking the silver. Not all of it, not at first. Just a little, to see what I could do. Just sufficient to make me strong enough to resist the ship's emotions. Enough to heal the fool without losing my vision to him. Was that possible? Enough to reach out to ask Shade's advice, perhaps to heal his body of the ravages of age and restore his mind. Could I do that? Would Nettle know more of what it could or could not do? If I drank it all, could I walk into Clara's and demand that all there kill themselves? Could it be that easy to destroy them and win back my daughter?
What are you doing down here?
Lant asked me. I turned to see him coming toward me, Purr and Spark trailing behind him. Where is Amber?
She's with the figurehead. She dismissed us. What are you doing?
Thinking. Where are the others?
Wintrow went back to Vivacia. She needs calming, I think. The Queen and Sorkor went back to Divitown. I think they will try to find Kennetson and reason with him. Brashen and Althea went to their stateroom and shut the door, and Amber had Spark fetch her pipes, and she is playing for Paragon.
He drew breath and looked around the crew quarters.
You came here to think?
Yes.
Can you think while you work?
I turned to Clef's voice. It was humid below decks, and his face ran with sweat as he stepped out of the shadowy darkness of the hold.
I was just coming to look for you. We're short of crew and we need to move freight. Some of the crates have shifted, and a few look damp. Captain's wanted those up on deck. You said you'd pitch in. Now would be a good time.
I'm coming, I said.
Me too,
Lant added, and Purr nodded.
And me,
Spark asserted.
I'm part of this crew, now and to the end.
To the end, I thought morosely, and rose to follow them. A wave of vertigo swept over me, such that I abruptly sat down again on the sea chest.
There you are.
Satisfaction rang in the voice in my head.
I am coming for you. Prepare for me.
Fitz? Lent asked, concern in his voice. I stood slowly. My smile held back my fear and confusion. Tintaglia is coming for me, I said. Chapter 19. Another Ship, Another Journey.
Report to the Four. The Lurik, known as Beloved, continues to create restlessness among the other Luriks. He was caught attempting to remain in the village when the tide was coming in, and the other Luriks had already formed up to return to their cottages. He has upset those who have come to have their fortunes foretold by hypothesizing horrible calamities. He told one client that his son would marry a donkey, but that the children from that union would bring the family great joy. To another, he said simply, "How much money do you wish to give me to lie to you? My best lies are very expensive, but this one is free. You are a very wise woman to have come here to give me lots of money to lie to you." Twice I have beaten him, once with my hands and once with a strap. He begged me to lash him hard enough to tear the tattoos from his back. I believe he was sincere in desiring that. As soon as he healed and was to return to his duties in the marketplace, he clambered onto a pile of boxes and proclaimed to all that he was the true white prophet for this generation, and announced that he was being held prisoner in Clarys. He appealed to the crowd that immediately gathered to help him escape. When I seized him and shook him to silence, I was stoned by some of the onlookers, and it was only when two other guards intervened that I was able to drag him back within the walls. I believe that I have done my duty as well as any might, and I petition to be freed from responsibility for the Lurik known as Beloved. With the greatest respect, I say that I consider him both troublesome and dangerous to all. Lutius. My life had improved, or so I told myself. We were quartered in a nice cabin. The meals were regular, and Dwalia had few chances to beat me. Indeed, she seemed almost mellowed by our improved fortunes. Summer had found the seas. The winds were fresh and the storms were few. As a result of whatever glamour Vindelire had cast over me, the crew accepted my presence without comment or interest. If I lived my life from moment to moment, it was not too bad. Very little was expected of me. I fetched Dwalia's meals to the cabin and took away the empty dishes. When she walked on the deck in the afternoons with the captain, I followed at a decorous distance, in a pretense at maintaining the lady's virtue. But for now, the pretense was small. I sat on the deck outside the door of the captain's stateroom. When he had offered his stateroom to Lady Obricia, I do not think that Dwalia had realized that he expected to continue occupying it. I heard a rhythmic thudding from inside the cabin, and fondly hoped it was the top of her head against the bulkhead. The tempo was increasing, which saddened me. The times when Captain Dorful was occupying Dwalia were the most peaceful in my constrained existence. She was making little gasping shrieks now, barely audible through the stout plank walls. I heard shuffling footsteps coming down the companionway. I thought of the sea and the moving waves, and how the sunlight glittered on their tops. I thought of the seabirds flying high above us, and yet still looking so large. How big would such a bird be if it landed on the deck? As tall as me? What did they eat? Where did they nest or land to rest when we were so many days away from land? I filled my thoughts with those wide-winged white birds and thought of nothing else. When Vindelire crouched beside me, I wondered what he would look like if he were a bird. I imagined a beak for him, and glossy feathers, and orange-clawed feet with spurs like a rooster.
"Are they still in there?"
he asked in a hoarse whisper. I didn't look at him or reply. Long, shining grey feathers.
"I won't try to push into your thoughts."
"I don't believe you. I don't trust you. I don't believe you. I don't trust you." I just thought it, but I didn't lower my walls. He was not as powerful as he had been when he first took in the serpent spit, but he was still strong. I was starting to understand that unlike my father's magic, that was always with him, Vindaliya's magic depended on the potion. I wondered how long it would take before it dwindled away completely, before I could trust that my private plans remained private. Don't think of that.
I don't trust you. I don't believe you. I don't trust you.
You don't trust me.
He said it with such sadness that I almost felt rebuked. Except that he had taken the words from my thoughts and said them aloud. He wasn't to be trusted. Not at all. I knew that, down to my bones. I desperately needed an ally, but Vindaliya was not one.
I don't believe you. I don't trust you. I don't believe you. I don't trust you.
Poor Dwalia.
He was staring at the closed door, a look of dismay on his face.
He just goes on and on. She must blame me. I made Captain Dorful see her as the most beautiful woman he could imagine.
He scratched his head.
It has not been easy to keep him convinced of his desire for her. At all times, I must be aware of all who see her. It's very taxing.
What does he see when he looks at her? Damned curiosity. The question had been on my lips before I had recalled I must not speak to him. I tried to think only of the birds again. He smiled, pleased that I'd spoken to him.
I don't tell them what to see exactly. I tell them they see something they like. But Dwalia, I told the captain he would see a beautiful woman he wanted to help. I don't know exactly what she looks like to him.
He looked at me, waiting for my questions. I held them all back and thought of how the tip of every wave sometimes sparkled so brightly that I could not look at them for long.
For me, I told them all to see just a serving man. Unthreatening. Nobody to worry about.
He waited again. I held my silence.
I told them you were homely and dull and smelled bad.
Smelled bad? Again, I had not meant to speak.
So they would leave you alone. On the boat before this, there were some who looked at you and wanted what he does to poor Dwalia now.
He crossed his stubby arms on his chest.
I protect you, Bee, even when you hate and mistrust me. I protect you. I wish you could open your eyes and see that we are taking you to safety, to where you have always belonged. Dwalia has suffered so much for you, and you have rewarded her only with difficulty and physical attacks.
As if she had heard him and wished more of his sympathy, we heard a series of rising moans from within the cabin. Vindaliya looked from me to the door and then back to me.
Should we go in? Does she need us?
They're nearly done. I knew that they were mating, but had no clear idea of the mechanics of it. My days as sentry had taught me that it involved a lot of bumping noises and moans and left the cabin smelling sweaty. For a few hours, Dwalia would doze and be uninterested in persecuting me. I did not care what the captain did to her in his afternoon visits. Vindaliya seemed both foolish and patronizing as he told me,
"She must allow this. If she refused, it would be harder for me to keep him believing that he loves her. She endures this to win us safe passage to Clary's."
I started to tell him that I doubted it, but bit back my words. The less talk we exchanged, the better for me. Sunlight on the waves, grey birds flying. The moaning reached a higher pitch and pace, and then suddenly dwindled away in a descending sigh. A galloping series of thuds, and then all sound from the chamber abruptly ceased.
I will always wonder what it is like. I will never do that.
He spoke as wistfully as a child. Grey birds sliding across the blue sky, wind in our sails, waves sparkling.
I barely remember what they did to me. Only the pain. But they had to do it. They saw very soon that I should not make children for Clary's. Girls like me, they kill. And most of the boys. But Dwalia spoke for me and my sister, Odessa. We were twins, born of one of the purest white lineages, but flawed She kept me alive when all others thought I should die.
He spoke as if I should marvel at Dwalia's goodness.
You were so blind to her, so stupid.
Anger demolished my self-control.
She cut you like a bull-calf, and you grovel with thankfulness. Who is she to say you should never make a child? She strikes you and calls you names, and you sniff along behind her like a dog nosing another dog's piss. She feeds you filth to give you power, a magic she does not understand, and you let her decide how it will be used. She thinks nothing of you, Vindalaya, nothing at all, but you are too stupid to see how she uses you and how she will discard you the moment you become useless. She hits you and calls you names, but the moment she spars at you, you forgive it all and forget it. You call me brother, but you do not care that she intends to hurt me and then kill me. You know it as well as I do. You could have helped me. If you cared for me, you would have helped me. We should have fled when that last ship made port, and I could have gone home to my family, and you could have chosen a life for yourself. Instead, you helped her kill a woman who had done nothing bad to you and had been kind to me, and you threw aside the Chalcedian and left him to die for you after you compelled him to kill for her. You're a coward and a fool.
But I was the fool. From somewhere in a distant darkness, I heard a wolf's long howl fade. Then Vindalaya was inside my mind.
Be calm. I won't hurt you. Just let me see your secrets. What do you fear? Be calm, my brother. I won't hurt you. Just let me see.
He babbled excitedly as he whirled through my mind, stirring and flinging memories as if they were dead leaves and he an autumn storm. Wall after wall I raised to him, and each he tore and parted as if they were paper. I was dizzy and sickened with the assault of memories, each with an emotion attached to it. My mother fell and died. My mouth was torn when I was slapped. A cat purred, still and warm as I stroked him. I smelled bacon and fresh bread in a winter kitchen lit with candlelight and hearth fire. Fitzvigilant shamed me, and Perseverance fell as an arrow tore through him. Vindalaya was a greedy child, rummaging a platter of sweets, taking a bite of this one and a lick of that one, dirtying my memories with his eager sampling, as if he could own me by knowing me.
You do dream.
He was exultant. I felt pushed out of my own mind. I could not find a voice to shriek at him, nor fists to batter him. I was writing in my dream journal.
No, he must not see that. He must not read those.
And suddenly, all I knew were long, sharp, tearing teeth and a mouth that breathed hot breath. A father shouted,
Beware! He is more dangerous than you can know!
And I was suddenly in a cage where I could not retreat, and a stinking human hammered my ribs with fierce jabs of a stick I could not avoid. I had never known such pain. It did not stop. Over and over the man shouted curses at me and poked me savagely with the stick, as if he strove to thrust it right through me. I howled and shrieked and snarled. I leapt and fought the bars of the cage, but still the stick struck me, always looking for the softest parts of me, my belly, my throat, my anus and sex. I fell at last, yelping and whining, and still the beating went on. Abruptly, Vindalaya was gone. My mind was my own again. I slammed up wall after wall while my whole body shook with sobs. The remembered pain racked me and my tears flowed. But through them, I could see Vindalaya sprawled on his side, his mouth open, his eyes glassy, as if he had lost awareness. Like the wolf in the cage, I suddenly realized. Like Wolf Father.
I give you that pain to use against him. But do not think of me again. He must not find me. He must not know that you can write, or anything you have dreamed, and you must stop waiting for someone to save you. You must save yourself. Escape. Get home. But do not think of home right now. Think only of escape.
And Wolffather was gone, as if he had never existed, as if he was something I made up to give me courage, just as gone as my real father, and I suddenly knew I must not think of him either. Vindalaya sat up, but even sitting he was wobbly. He set his hands flat to the deck to either side of him and looked at me woefully.
What was that? You are not a wolf. You can't remember that.
His lower lip was trembling as if I'd cheated him at a game. I felt a surge of hatred. I can remember this, I told him, and I flung at him every moment of the beating Dwalia had given me on the night when my shoulder had been jerked out of its socket. He recoiled from me, and I added, and this, and I found myself grinding my teeth together as I recalled for him exactly how it had felt to bite Dwalia's cheek, how her blood had tasted and felt as it ran over my chin, and how I had ignored the blows she struck me as she tried to shake me loose. He put hands up to his cheeks and shook his head.
No!
His voice dwindled away. He popped his eyes open wide and stared at me.
Don't show me that. Don't make me feel chewing her face.
I met his gaze with a flat stare. Then stay out of my thoughts, or I will show you worse than that. I had no idea what I could dredge up that would be worse for him, but for now he was out of my mind, and I'd make any threats I could to keep him out. I thought about how he had betrayed me, how he'd helped them find and kill Trader Acriel. I thought of how he had pounced on my chain when I'd tried to flee on the docks. I summoned all the hate I could muster and pointed the thought at him in a way I never had before.
I despise you.
His eyes jolted wide and he leaned away from me. I realized that at this moment I was stronger than he was. He had barged into my mind when my guard was down, but it had been my strength that forced him out. He had used his full power against me, but I had won. Just then, the stateroom door opened and our handsome captain emerged. His clothing was as immaculate as ever, his cheeks slightly flushed. He glanced down at me and then at Vindelire. I saw puzzlement cloud his gaze, as if we were not what he had expected to see. Then I felt the wash of Vindelire's thoughts against his mind. His brow unfurrowed, and the small scowl on his lips became a puckering of distaste.
Lady Abricia, this maid of yours. Well, I vow that when we reach Clara's, we shall replace her with someone clean and pleasant to look upon. Away, wretch!
He nudged me with the side of his foot, and I edged away from him, and then stood up. As you please, sir, I said courteously. I was half a dozen steps away when I heard Dwalia's voice.
No, my dear. Thank you all the same. Come here, B. Tidy this chamber immediately.
I halted on the verge of dashing away.
You heard your mistress. Be prompt.
Yes, sir. I lowered my eyes meekly. Nonetheless, as I walked back past him, he cuffed the back of my head hard, nearly sending me sprawling. I struck the side of the door and then scurried inside, Vindelire on my heels.
And that one scarcely looks fit enough to be your bodyguard. He should be replaced with a strong man who knows his business.
The captain shook his head and then, with a sigh, added,
I will see you again this evening, my dear. Time will move slow as honey until then,
Dwalia said, her voice thick and lazy. Then, in an entirely different voice, she barked,
Tidy this room,
as she shut the door. The captain's chamber was very grand, as wide as the stern of the ship, with windows that looked out on three sides. The walls were panelled with a fine-grained red wood, and the rest of the room was cream or gilt. There was a large bed, fat with cream feather pillows, and a table made of wood the colours of rust and moss, big enough for six tall chairs to surround it. There was a deep cushioned seat by one of the windows, a separate chart table that folded down from the wall, and a tiny chamber where one's waist went down a chute and out into the sea. Nightly, Dwalia locked me in that cramped and noisome space, lest I attack her while she slept. Clothing littered the polished planks of the floor, all of it the excessively flouncy, lacy garments the captain had purchased for Lady Obricia in the 2 days before we left our last port. I gathered the clothing in a slow armful, including a petticoat of stiff lace that crinkled in my arms. It smelled of a lovely perfume, another gift from the captain. I carried the garments to a chest with roses carved into the lid and began to layer them carefully back into it. The chest smelled fragrant, like a forest where spices grew.
"Hurry up,"
Dwelia commanded me. To Vindelire, she said,
"Gather those cups and plates and take them back to the galley. The captain does not like to see his quarters untidy."
She went to the cushioned seat and sat down, staring out over the water. Her long, bony feet and muscular calves were bare beneath her short robe of thin red silk. Her draggled hair was sweaty at the roots, and my bite mark on her cheek was becoming a shiny pink crater. She was scowling to herself.
"We go so slowly. The captain tells me that this is not the right time of year to make the passage to Clarys, that the currents are good for traveling north and west, not south and east. I think he tarries on purpose, to have more time with Lady Obricia."
I wondered if she was complaining or bragging, but I said nothing. Lovely clothes, sweet perfumes, carved roses. I kept my thoughts fixed on what I could see and held my walls as tight as I could.
"She has stolen magic from you."
Vindelire had not even begun to gather the plates and cups from their shared meal. Instead, he pointed at me with a shaking hand as he made his accusation. Dwelia turned away from the window and gave him an angry glare.
"What? She used our magic against me. Just now, outside the door, she made me think about biting you and how she hates me."
Dwelia transferred her angry gaze to me.
"That's not possible. She did it. She stole magic, and that's why I can't make her do what you want."
He drew in a deep breath, a tattling child on the verge of tears. I stared, hate at him, and he recoiled.
"She's doing it now,"
he wailed, and threw up his hands before his face as if they could stem the flow of what I felt for him.
"No,"
Dwelia shouted, and fairly leapt from her seat. I both cowered and lifted my fists to defend myself, but she ignored me and charged across the room to the carved chest. With a fine disregard for the work I'd just completed, she flung open the lid and began to toss the clothing from the chest onto the floor behind her until she reached her washed but well-worn traveling clothes. She dredged up a leather pouch and peered into it. She drew out the glass tube. The remainder of the serpent spit was clotted in the bottom.
"No, it's here. She hasn't stolen it. Stop making excuses."
For a long moment, we both stared at her. Vindelire spoke slowly, his voice full of helpless longing.
"I need the rest of it now. Don't you want me to be able to do everything you ask of me?"
A pleading desire was in that last question.
"It's not for you right now. You've had all I can spare."
She looked at him, and then looped the string of the pouch around her neck so that it hung between her breasts.
"There's only a bit left. We must save it for an emergency."
"She doesn't trust you, Vindelire. She taught you to want that serpent spit, and now she doesn't trust you not to steal it from her." I flung my foolish words at both of them.
"Serpent? Who told you that? Vindelire, are you telling her my secrets? Have you betrayed me?"
No, I told her nothing. Nothing."
He hadn't told me. I had found that information in him when his mind was unguarded before me. I wished I had kept that knowledge to myself, except that it now seemed to be a breach in their alliance.
"Liar!"
she barked. She advanced on him, her meaty hand held high, and he quailed, crouching down before her, his head ducked and hidden behind his hands. She slapped him, and when her blow fell on his knuckles, she grunted in annoyed pain and seized a handful of hair on top of his head. She shook him savagely by it, as Vindelire shrieked and protested his innocence. I moved closer to the door, while looking for anything I might use as a weapon. Any moment, I feared that both might turn on me and come after me. Instead, she flung his head aside with a force that sent him staggering. He fell to the floor and curled there, sobbing. She scowled at him and then looked at me.
"What did he tell you of the serpent potion?"
nothing, I answered truthfully. And then, to deflect her, I shook my head pityingly and lied. It's well known where I come from, but few are stupid enough to use it. That made her stare. Then,
no, no, it is my discovery, my new magic, a new ability that some who carry white blood can master, but only some.
She stared at me, hatred burning in her.
You think you are so clever, don't you? You seek to turn him against me. He told me all, you stupid little cheat. How you manipulated him into helping you. How you made him betray me. It won't happen again. I promise you that. And more, I promise you a long and painful life in Clarez. Do you think you have suffered traveling with me? Oh, no. You will know all your father knew, and more.
I stared back at her. She was edging closer to me. Closer. No weapons. On this ship, everything was firmly fastened down, lest wild weather toss things about. She intended to seize me and beat out of me whatever I knew. I wasn't even sure what I knew, or what I could do with my newfound ability. Was it the skill, such as my father had? It had to be. Not some filthy magic she'd inflicted on Vindelire by making him drink serpent spit. My magic. The magic of my family. But I wasn't trained. All that I'd read in my father's papers said you needed lots of training to use the magic. But I'd used it, hadn't I? I knew that I'd made Vindelire feel old pain of mine, and be aware of my hate. Perhaps that had only worked because he was already trying to reach into my thoughts. Or maybe I had stolen magic from him. Was there anything I could do to Dwalia? I stared at her and gathered up my hatred for her at the same time as I pressed down my fear. I looked at her face and gathered up the scar from my bite and how badly she had smelled and how disgusting I found her. They seemed small weapons. What could I do to her? What could I make her feel? Would I be able to make her feel anything, or had it worked with Vindelire only because he had reached into my mind first? I was panting with fear. Control. My father's scroll said I must have control. I took one long, slow breath, and then another. She was watching me. How could I focus my thoughts when at any moment she might spring?
Become the hunter, not the prey.
Wolf father, faint as distant bird call. I found a rolling growl in the back of my throat. Her eyes widened, but I marked that Vindelire had uncoiled and was sitting up. Watch them both. Where was she most vulnerable? She'd grown leaner and harder during our most recent travels. I tried to imagine hitting her. I could, but I couldn't imagine it hurting her enough to make her stop. Once she got hold of me, she would hurt me, badly. I needed to focus an attack on her. But where?
Her mind. Be wary. A way out is always a way in.
I had no time to worry about what he meant by that. I pushed at her with all my hatred and disgust for her, hoping she would be hurt by it. Instead, it was like pouring oil on a kitchen fire. I felt her own hatred for me surge and leap like devouring flames. She sprang at me like a cat upon a mouse. And like a mouse, I dodged away, barely avoiding her snatching claws. She could not move as fast as I could, and although she did not crash into the wall, she staggered sideways. When I ducked under the table and emerged at the other end, she pounded on the table so that the dishes jumped and shouted at Vindelire to
grab her! Hold her!
He got to his feet, but he was uncertain and awkward. I shot him a fierce reminder of how I had bitten Dwalia's face, and was gratified when he reached with both hands to cover his cheeks. But Dwalia was still ardent in her pursuit. I kept the table between us, but she showed no signs of tiring as she chased me round and round it. I slipped under it to catch my breath, but she kicked at me and pulled the chairs away from the table and tossed them aside. When I emerged, the tumbled chairs became obstacles for both of us as I strove to keep the cluttered table between us. She was breathing harder than I was, but she continued to pant and shout,
This time I will kill you, you little wretch. I will kill you.
She halted abruptly, palms braced flat on the table, breathing heavily. In between gasps, she managed,
Vindelire, you worthless failure. Catch her. Hold her for me.
She will bite me in the face. Her magic has promised this. She will bite me.
He stood rocking back and forth with his hands still clasped over his face.
You idiot!
She shouted, and with a strength I had scarcely imagined she possessed, she lifted one of the heavy wooden chairs and heaved it at him. He shrieked and danced back as it fell short.
You catch her and hold her for me. Be useful, or I'll have the captain throw you over the side.
I glanced at the door, but knew that by the time I reached it and struggled with the heavy latch, she'd be on me. Even if I escaped into the companionway, eventually I'd be found and returned to her. I should not have fed her anger. I should have let her beat me before she became murderous. What to do? What to do? She was breathing more slowly. In a moment she'd be after me again. She wouldn't stop, not until she'd won.
Give her what she wants.
Let her kill me?
Let her win. Make her think she has won.
How? There was no answer, and a strange trembling went through me as I felt Vindelire poking at my thoughts, at my being, as if he had just noticed an odd growth on my face. It was tentative, almost fearful, and I slapped it away with another burst of my memory of chewing on Dwalia's cheek. He fell back, but it cost me. Heedless of the dishes, Dwalia flung herself flat on the table and reached across to seize the front of my shirt. A vivid memory of the last beating I'd received from her flashed through my mind and crossed to hers. The glittering light of satisfaction in her eyes was almost more than I could bear. I understood. I gave her the taste of blood in my mouth, the torn skin inside my cheek, the rocking pain of a loosened tooth. Abruptly, I was seeing myself as she'd seen me, pale, my short hair matted with sweat, a smear of blood down my chin. It took every bit of control I had, but I let my weight fall as I went limp in her grip. She did not release my shirt, but as I sank to the floor, she had to slide her body over the table to keep her hold on me. Several dishes struck the floor. I lolled my head as if stunned and let my mouth hang open. She managed an open-handed slap, but she was in an awkward position, and it had little momentum behind it. I still cried out as if in agony. I gave her not my hatred, but my fear and pain and despair, and she sucked it in like a thirsty horse at a water trough. She maneuvered herself off the table. She kicked me, and again I cried out and let the force of her kick push me under the table. She kicked me again, in the belly, but she was up against the table's edge, and it was not as bad as if it had been in the open. Again I shrieked and offered her an awareness of the pain I felt. Panting, she licked her lips. I lay where I was, moaning. Oh, she had hurt me. She had beaten me to where I was barely conscious. I would hurt for weeks from this beating. I gave it all to her, everything I could imagine she could want. She turned away from me, breathing harshly through her nose. She had what she'd wanted from me, and that anger was satiated. She was done with me, but Vindelire had foolishly ventured too close to her. She turned on him and closed her fist before slamming it into his face. He fell away from her, gasping and sobbing, hands clutching his nose.
You are useless. You couldn't even catch a little girl. I had to do it myself. Look what you made me do. If she dies of that beating, it will be your fault. She is full of lies, and you are too. Stole my magic. What is that tale? Something you tell me to explain why you won't control her? She dreams.
Vindelire had lifted his face from his hands. His wobbling cheeks were scarlet, his little eyes running tears. Blood trickled from his nose.
She is the liar. She dreams, but does not write them down, or even tell you.
You stupid wretch. Everyone dreams, not just whites. Her dreams mean nothing.
She dreamed the candle dream. She wrote it down, the whole poem. I saw it in her mind. She can read and write, and she dreamed the candle dream.
I felt a sudden terror. The candle dream. I almost let myself recall it.
No!
Heedless of any risk, I pushed a desperate thought at her.
He lies. I'm a stupid girl with no letters. He's just making excuses and trying to avoid punishment. You know he lies. You are correct that he is a liar. You are too clever to be fooled by his lies.
It was a panicky thrust of thoughts. I think it reached her only because she was already angry at him and was only too happy to have reasons for her anger confirmed. She beat him. She picked up a heavy metal water pitcher from the washstand and turned it into a weapon. He did not defend himself, and I did not intervene. Instead, I huddled under the table. There was blood on my chin from my split lip. I smeared it on my face. I felt the impact of each of her blows on Vindelire, and I stored those sensations as I winced at each one. I pushed into his mind that she had beaten me more severely, and in his distracted and beleaguered state, I felt him accept that information as truth. He knew the sort of pain she could administer. He knew it better than anyone. And in a gush of information as sudden as a spurt of blood, I did too. The memory that burst from him sickened me, and my walls fell before it.
A way out is a way in.
Then, as the wisdom of Wolffather's words sank into my mind, I closed my thoughts from him and worked to fortify my walls. Thicker and tighter I built them, until I was aware of the beating he was taking, but no longer flinching at each blow. When he had the elixir, he was strong, far stronger than I was in this magic. But I understood now, a way in is also a way out. When I reached out to touch his mind or Dwalia's, it was like opening the gates to them. Did he know that too? Did he know that when he tried to invade my thoughts, he offered me a highway into him? I doubted it, and after what I'd glimpsed, I never wanted to see inside his mind again. I lay curled on the floor under the table, and tears flowed from my eyes and broken sobs from my lungs. I fought for control. I told myself I must ponder what I'd learned. I had a weapon, but it was not hardened, and I did not know how to wield it. He had a vulnerability and did not know it. Information about him and his dismal childhood had poured into me when he'd manifested the power of the serpent potion. I cut away any sympathy I might have felt for him and focused on the edges of those memories. I'd seen a fortified citadel standing tall on an island. Towers topped with heads like the skulls of monsters looked out over a harbor and the mainland. I'd glimpsed a lovely garden where pale children played, but never Vindelire. Those children were tended by patient servants and taught to read and write as soon as they could walk. Their dreams were harvested and preserved as carefully as soft fruit. I saw a market with many booths shaded by bright awnings. The smells of smoked fish and honey cakes and something spicy mingled in the air. Smiling people moved among the booths, making purchases and putting them into net bags. Tiny dogs with barely any fur scampered and barked shrilly. A girl with flowers woven into her hair sold bright yellow sweets from a tray. All the people I saw seemed clean and well-clothed and happy. That was Clary's. That was where they were taking me. But I doubted that the lovely walled garden and doting servants awaited me, or the bright market under the warm sunshine. Instead, I recalled with horror the searing glimpse of torchlit stone walls lined with elevated benches and a bloody creature chained to a table who screamed piteously as Dwalia offered a delicate knife to an impassive man. Pen, ink, and paper waited on a tall stand near her. When the person screamed out a recognizable word, she stepped aside to jot it down and to add notes, perhaps on what pain had torn words from him. She seemed cheery and efficient, her hair neatly braided in a crown around her head. A canvas smock protected her pastel blue garments. Vindelire stood at the edge of the theater, a despised outcast who averted his eyes and trembled at each screech wrung from the victim. He'd understood little of the reasons for tormenting the writhing creature. Some of the seated onlookers were watching with mouths ajar and eyes wide, and others laughed into their hands with strange shame blushing their cheeks. Some were pale of skin, hair and eyes, and others were as dark-haired and warm-skinned as my parents. There were old people and people of working age, and four children who looked younger than me, and they all watched the torture as if it were an entertainment. And then, to my horror, the poor creature on the table stiffened. His blood-tipped fingers strained wide against his restraints, and his head thrashed wildly for a moment. Then he was still. The panting sounds he had made ceased, and I thought he had died. Then, in a terrible exhalation of breath, he screamed a name.
"Fitz Chivalry! Fitz! Help me! Oh, help me! Fitz! Please! Fitz!"
Dwalia was transfigured. She lifted her head as if she had heard the voice of a god calling her, and a terrible smile came over her face. Whatever she wrote in the book, she did with a flourish. And then she paused, pen lifted, and made a request.
"Again," she said to the tormentor. "Again, please. I wish to be certain."
"Certainly," the man replied. He was pale with colourless hair, but the gaudiness of his fine garments made up for his lack of colour. Even the olive apron he wore to protect his jade robe was a thing of beauty, embroidered with words in a language I did not know. His ears were studded with emeralds. He flourished the nasty little tool he held at the four young whites. Their eyes were very large as he said, "You are too young to recall when Beloved was a Lurik, just your age, but I do. Even then he was a defiant and obtuse youngster, breaking all rules just as you break the rules, and think yourselves too clever for us to know about it. Look where it has led him. Know that it can lead you here just as easily if you do not learn to master your own wills for the good of the servants." The lips of the smallest one quivered until she clapped a hand over her mouth. One of the others hugged himself, but the two tallest drew themselves straighter and held their mouths tight. A beautiful young woman with pale gold hair and a complexion like milk stood up. "Felady," impatience ruled her voice, "lecture your little darlings later. Force Beloved to utter the name again." She turned to the spectators and looked directly at one old woman seated next to a man whose yellow robes contrasted with the pale paste on his face.
"Hear it, the name he has concealed so long, the one that proves what Felody and I have been saying. His catalyst continues to live, and they conspire to work against us still. The unexpected son has been concealed from us. Has Beloved not done enough damage to us already? You must allow us to send Dwalia forth to avenge her mistress and win us possession of the son who will otherwise be our downfall. Over and over the dreams have warned us of him."
In response, the older woman stood and fixed the young woman with a glare.
"Symph, you speak before all these people of things that concern only the four. Mind your own tongue."
She stood, lifted her pale blue skirts to avoid the blood, and strode majestically from the slaughter floor. The yellow-coated man next to her watched her go, stood as if undecided, and then sat down again. He nodded to Symph and the butcher that they should proceed, and they did. "My father's name," that was what they made the tattered creature scream, not just once, but over and over and over. And when the repeated screaming of my father's name was finished, and they had tumbled the unconscious body off the table, and the guards had dragged the poor wretch away, Vindelire recalled dashing buckets of water on the spattered floor and table, and then scrubbing them clean. He cared little for the tortured man. He focused on his work and his fear. A small chunk of flesh had clung to the floor. He scraped it up with his thumbnail and tossed it into his scrubbing bucket. He knew that if he contravened Dwalia's will, he might be the next one shackled for a hard lesson on the table. Even now he knew it still might await him. She would not hesitate, and still he lacked the will to flee or defy her. And I knew in my deepest core that my
brother
would not risk himself to save me from such a fate. That memory made me tremble. The poor creature on the table had screamed for my father and begged him to come and save him. I was missing too many links to make a chain of reasons, but my instincts made a blind leap. That was the day Dwalia had won permission to come to Withywoods. That was the day my fate had been sealed. I watched her now as if from a great distance. And the wretch on the table? It did not seem possible he could have survived. Surely he could not have become the beggar at Oaksby Water. Could not have been my father's fool. Jagged bits of information stabbed at my thoughts. Dwalia had spoken of a father I did not know. The pieces could not possibly fit together. But her earlier threat to me insisted that they did. That table was what she had promised me. Dwalia was still kicking Vindelire, but she was panting with the effort. With each kick she grunted, and her buttocks wobbled. When she had reduced Vindelire to a huddled and sobbing mass in the corner, she came back to me. She aimed a kick at me, but I had chosen my shelter carefully, and she could not deliver a forceful blow. She flung the now bloody pitcher at me. It only grazed me. I yelped convincingly anyway, and scuttled away, staring up at her dolefully, blood smeared on my face. I made my chin quiver and blubbered at her.
"Please, Dwalia, no more. No more. I will obey you. See? I will work hard. Please don't hurt me."
I scooted out from under the table, dragging one leg. Hunched over, I hopped about the room, gathering up the clothing she had scattered. With each lurch, I begged her to forgive me and promised obedience and atonement. She watched me, suspicion and satisfaction warring in her expression. I stood weeping by the clothing chest, seeping pain and fear at her and Vindelire. Inspired, I added a touch of despair and discouragement. I held up each garment.
"See how nicely I'm folding it?"
I gulped back a sob.
"I can be useful. I can be helpful. I've learned my lesson. Please don't hurt me any more. Please. Please."
It was not easy, and I could not be sure how well it was working. But she gave me a triumphant sneer and returned to the tousled bed, plopping down onto it with a satisfied sigh. Then Vindelire caught her eye. He was curled on the floor like a fat larva under a log, sobbing into his hands.
"Tidy up those dishes, I said," she barked at him.
He rolled and then sat up, snuffling. When he lifted his battered face from his hands, I winced. His eyes were starting to swell, and blood had sheeted over his chin. Blood and saliva dripped from his sagging mouth. He looked at me in misery, and I wondered if he had felt my inadvertent sympathy. I thickened my walls. I think he felt that, for he gathered his brows and looked at me darkly.
"She's doing it now,"
he said in a low, sullen voice, his words muffled by swollen lips. Dwalia cocked her head at him.
"Think about this, Unman. She has learned her lesson. See how she cowers and obeys me? That is all I require of her, for now. And if she can do the magic, if I can teach her what I require of her, what need have I of you? You had best be at least as useful as she is."
Then she looked at me and chilled my soul with her simpering smile. I heard Vindelire take a snotty breath. I glanced at him and saw something more frightening than Dwalia's smile. He glowered at me, his face full of jealousy.
Chapter 20. Belief.
I truly wish I knew more to tell you. I feel as if I should know more, but he has always been private when speaking of his early days. What I do know, with certainty, can be quickly written. An accident of birth cheated Lord Shade of the power and respect that went to his elder brother and younger sister. Shrewd became king. His younger sister was, some say, the cause of her mother's death, for the birth was difficult, and Queen Constance was never healthy after that. Raised as a princess, she was nevertheless doomed to die in her turn, giving birth to a son, August. His sad end you already know. In an effort to skill through him to his future queen, Verity unintentionally burned out his cousin's mind. August was never sound after that, physically or mentally, and died at a relatively young age in the merciful obscurity of a retirement to Withywoods. Patience, my father's wife, and once a queen-in-waiting, had the care of him until he died in his sleep one winter's day. The death of my father in an accident, and then August's sliding away, were what led her, I believe, to return to Buckkeep Castle to attempt to take on my upbringing. But it is Shade you wished to know about. He has never been forthcoming about his early days. His mother was a soldier. How she came to bear the king's bastard, we will never know. And I know little of his mother's passing, or how he was sent on to Buckkeep Castle. Once he mentioned to me that his mother had left a letter, and that shortly after she died, her husband gave that scroll and a packet of travel rations to the young Shade, set him on a mule, and sent him to Buckkeep. The letter was addressed to the king, and by some extraordinary circumstances, actually reached him. And so his royal family discovered him, perhaps for the first time, but who can truly know about that? In either case, he was taken in. For all the years in which he taught me, I know little of how he was educated, save that his instructor was harsh. While he was never acknowledged even as a bastard, I do believe that his elder brother treated him well. From what I personally observed, he and Shrewd were fond of each other, and Shrewd counted on Shade as a counselor, as well as an assassin and spymaster. I have gathered that Shade had a few lively and enjoyable years as a handsome young man before the accident that scarred him and sent him into hiding in the castle walls. I think it likely there is much more to that tale as to why he made himself vanish, but we are unlikely to unearth it. I do know that he desperately wished to be tested for the skill and educated in the family magic. That was denied to him. I suspect he had other magical talents, namely scrying in water, for more than once it seemed very unlikely to me that his spies could have possibly informed him in a timely way of events that took place at a distance from Buckkeep. But to be denied the skill both rankled and grieved him. I think it was perhaps one of the most foolish choices our royal ancestors ever committed. So it is, my dear, that now that he has proven at least an erratic ability to skill, and has access to what remains of the skill library, he recklessly indulges himself in trying to master it. He has always been one to experiment, and danger does not dissuade him from risking himself, or indeed his apprentices. I do not know if this information can help you persuade him to be more temperate and accord you the respect you deserve as the Queen's skill mistress. Please, if you can avoid letting him know that I am the source of this information, I would greatly appreciate it. He may have trained me to be a spy, but would be the first to object if his old apprentice spied upon him.
Unsigned missive to skill mistress Nettle.
What does Tintaglia want with you? Brashen asked me. I wiped sweat from my face. I had some questions for her when we were in Kelsingra. I was hoping to discover if dragons bore a grudge against the servants.
To recruit them to your cause?
Perhaps. Or to gain any bit of knowledge to use against them. He wiped his hands down his trousers and took a fresh grip on the barrel.
It might not be the wisest thing to do, sending a dragon in to rescue a child.
I wasn't thinking of that at the time. I just wanted Clara's destroyed.
But if your child is there...
There it was, the very thought I most wanted to avoid. Be in the midst of a dragon attack. I refused the idea. Brashen cocked his head at me as he stared at my face.
You don't think she's alive, do you?
His voice dropped low. I shrugged. It was the last question I wanted to ponder.
Let's get this done, I suggested.
He nodded grimly. We had both stopped to breathe. We were taking on a cask of water. It should have been a simple task, but Paragon was determined to make it almost impossible. He had listed away from the small boat that had come alongside with the cask, and then, amid our hoisting it up to the deck, he had listed in the other direction. It was our second day of struggling against the ship.
Paragon had blocked our efforts to offload his cargo. Today's effort to bring on water and fresh food for the crew was twice the work it should have been. In the midst of those difficulties, Althea and Brashen had received my news about Tintaglia with a marked lack of interest. As Brashen had said at the time,
"Could a dragon's arrival make our situation any worse?"
Althea had replied,
"I will pass the news to Wintrow, and he will let Etta know. They can prepare for her as best they can."
She had added sourly,
"A dragon visit probably presents all sorts of problems. At this moment, all I can say is, I'm glad they're not mine."
Brashen had nodded grimly.
"We have enough of our own,"
he confirmed, and that had closed that conversation. Paragon was delaying our departure in ways I had never imagined. He rocked, he listed, he jammed his hatches shut. Althea and Brashen gritted their teeth and joined in to work the deck alongside their diminished crew. That first day, Clef had mustered Purr and Spark, and then regarded Lant and me with his hands on his hips.
"It may not be the work you were born to, but I need you. Beginning today, while we're still in port, you will each join a watch."
And we had. Brashen's and Althea's efforts to hire more crew or persuade former crew members to return were dismal failures.